Hello and welcome to Killing Arden, a short series of workshop works through Arden of Faversham, a play by unknown authors from the early 1590s, nominal date of sort of 1591-ish. It is based on a true story. This is a true crime adaptation. It's our first surviving and possibly groundbreaking. It's always slightly difficult to know these things based on the actual surviving play record, but it does seem that Arden was fairly successful and influential on a then burgeoning true crime market in dramatic adaptations, most of which we have already covered on our exploring sessions on the YouTube channel, which we have also already done a first look at Arden of Faversham. But this time we're looking at it primarily to talk about it as adaptation, as a text that we're going to adapt for the podcast. Not this season. It was voted for by our wonderful patrons. And if you want to vote for future plays we do, you can become a patron today. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. It was voted for, but it was slightly beyond us with our resources at the moment. We're this close, really, really close. For the listeners at home, I'm holding my fingers up, and finger and thumb, very narrow gap to being able to do this. But another play won out in our patron vote. And so this is the runner-up position for Arden, of that we're going to work through it and actually effectively do our audio adaptation as we go. So the usual questions for audio adaptation: is exposition clear from the outset? Do people use their names enough? Do we need to add people talking to each other and using each other's names more? I'm just scanning the page and I can already see that the first two characters talk to each other using each other's name straight off the bat. But usually it's that sort of three times is a charm rule for any scene. So we might be looking for more opportunities to throw in exposition. We've already looked at the source material for this from Hollingshed, and I'll be doing vaguely keeping an eye to see how the two tally. But I seem to recall from last time when we did that that the two are actually very, very similar in various ways. So it's trying on some level to remain true to the true life things. To read through the various parts, we don't quite have enough readers, but we're not trying to do it properly. We're trying to tease it out a bit. Reading today, as we try to get to the end of scene one, which is quite an epic scene, actually. It's quite long for this exercise, so we may not get through it all. We have in the room Sarah, Alan, and Bryony.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Robert Crichton. And details of who we are will be in the show description. So scene one, opening thereof, we have the entrance of Arden and Franklin. The setting is generally speaking domestic for much of the play. This is presumably an interior, but I'm not certain yet because there is no note in the script precisely where this physically is set. So that's something else in terms of building an audio production. What are the rooms like that people are standing in? How much reverb do I need to add? Do we record it on location? Location is something I'm quite keen on for true crime material, to give it that sort of documentary feel, even though this play isn't necessarily much of a documentary. Engaging and fun, though it is in many ways. It is about a real murder. So, with that in mind, I will ask Alan, could you read Arden? And Sarah, could you read Franklin for this initial little two-person exchange?
Mm-hmm. Arden, cheer up thy spirits and droop no more. My gracious lord, the Duke of Somerset, hath freely given to thee and to thy heirs, by letters patents from his majesty, all the lands of the Abbey of Faversham. Here are the deeds, sealed and subscribed with his name and the king's. Read them, and leave this melancholy mood.
Franklin, thy love prolongs my weary life. And but for thee, how odious were this life, that shows me nothing but torments my soul, and those foul objects that offend mine eyes, which makes me wish for this veil of heaven, The earth hung o'er my head and covered me. Love letters passed twixt Mobsby and my wife, and they have privy meetings in the town. Hey, on his finger could I spy the ring, which at our marriage day the priest put on. Can any grief be half so great as this?
Well, comfort thyself, sweet friend. It is not strange that women will be false and wavering.
Aye, but to dote on such a one as he is monstrous, Ratcliffe, and intolerable.
Why, what is he?
A botcher, and no better at the first, who, by base brokerage getting some small stock, crept into the service of a nobleman. By his servile flattery and fawning, is now become the steward of his house, and bravely jets it in his silken gown.
No nobleman will countenance such a peasant.
Yes, the Lord Clifford, he that loves not me, but through his favour let him not grow proud, for were he by the Lord Protector backed, he should not make me to be pointed at. I am by birth a gentleman of blood. That injurious ribald that attempts to violate my dear wife's chastity, the dear I hold her love as dear as heaven, shall on the bed which he thinks to defile see his dissevered joints and sinews torn, while on the planches pants his weary body, smeared in the channels of his lustful blood.
Be patient, gentle friend, and learn of me to ease thy grief and save her chastity. Entreat her fair. Sweet words are fittest engines to race the flint walls of a woman's breast. In any case, be not too jealous, nor make no question of her love to thee, but, as securely, presently take horse and lie with me at London all this term. For women, when they may, will not, but being kept back, straight grow outrageous.
Though this abhors reason, yet I'll try it, and call her forth, and presently take leave. How, Alice?
And then we'll pause. There's a lot of information being thrown at us throughout this. Character and setting. How intimate is this? Because, of course, we don't have to start with people walking in. You know, if this is in their sort of front parlour, is this at night? Is this at day? When would two chaps be able to be... Because this is one of the things about, you know, this sort of period of intimacy when you'd be left alone. A household is often busy. It's often hard to have a conversation privately. And it's quite difficult to see how all that that fits together. So yeah, where do we set this? Is if at the moment I'm feeling late at night and, you know, fireside and that Arden's drinking, and that this is actually maybe whispered. I don't know if other people are feeling that. I mean, we've got the sound effect of some deeds being handed over, so paper rustling, I have already noted. But otherwise, that and maybe some cups moving, because we've got class warfare, we've got snobbery, we've got some sort of some background misogyny going on here, because both Franklin sort of plays into that. You know, they're both talking about Arden's wife and women in general in derogatory ways. So there's this very male world going on here. And that also goes to the question of casting as well, as, you know, because often I'll play around with gender and move things around. But for the world of this play, is that a good idea? Certainly for these characters. You know, do we balance our balance sheet with a different production that is goes more the other way? Thoughts in the room about this opening scene, Sarah, and then Bryony.
I would say yes. With the gender, I mean, you know me, I will gender swap cast whenever possible. But I actually think with this that opening is really so very masculine and very misogynistic, which I think you need for the you know, the way the story is going to unfold. So I'd be tempted to just cast two guys in this role, to actually stick to the gendered casting. And the thing of when it is, that's really interesting. I mean, I would say it could definitely be the evening. The other time it could be is quite early in the morning, or sort of not really early in the morning, but kind of coffee time, as we would say now, because you're thinking of the times when the house is quieter. Mm. And so after dinner, obviously, after the dinner plates have been cleared away, the house would be quieter. But also, like, after the initial bustle of the morning chores have been completed, there's usually there's a kind of like lull.
I've just read ahead and I've noticed the text does explicitly tell us when it's set.
Oh, okay. So we need not continue with this conversation.
I think it is a very good conversation to be having about the nature of this scene. Mm. But it's also a good point about early modern. That's like when are you likely to be able to be alone? Mm. And actually, Alice is literally about to come on and say, "What mean you to get up so early?"
There you go. So it is early in the morning.
But okay. If it's first thing in the morning, when you're perhaps hoping that you've caught out the rest of the household, that they're not up yet. Especially if Arden, I mean, by that line that's about to come up from Alice, "What mean you to get up so early?" It sounds like Arden doesn't get up in the morning.
No.
Everybody else gets up and does some work in the morning, but he doesn't. And that again feels like a character point.
Mm, well, maybe he's drinking heavily every night before. So who knows?
Anyway, having answered by actually reading the play properly, my question, Bryony, then Alan.
Yeah, just I agree with what you were saying about gender casting. I think because of the nature of it, because it's a true crime thing, it's going to be a bit jarring to mess about with the gender casting for that. I think it's just easier to do it as represented, really.
I mean, it's one of these problems with aiming for something that's more naturalistic. It tends to make a slightly less critical, perhaps, of what's going on here. I mean, I do know that in performance with an audience, there's an awful lot of laughs that come out of it. And actually, you know, if it was a live show, I might not be feeling quite so torn on this point, but because you can play with those gender expectations in a way I'm not so sure audio is as well equipped for. But one always has to be a little careful with what naturalism and realism is doing, because it sometimes, shall we say, politically is not great. Anyway, Alan.
Yeah, I mean, you've answered in some ways the question, but I must admit I was seeing this as two gentlemen who were presumably fairly well lubricated with port or whatever the then equivalent was, which I suppose could actually link in with why are you up so early in the morning if they've actually been to bed.
Mm. I don't think can convey that in audio, but that might be a stage.
They've had
option.
An all-night drinking session.
Mm.
And are as lubricated as newts.
Mm. But then, you know, I think there's an almost, the reason why I leapt towards alcohol was just simply to sort of excuse some of the or to explain why they were saying some of the things they were saying. But actually, I think it's who they are and the society of the time. We don't need to get them drunk for them to say things that are a little unpleasant. Sarah.
Yes, I agree. And the reason I thought it might be early in the morning before we actually realised that it was because he's got this these letters patent. I mean, if they've been together all evening, he wouldn't be giving him the letters patent now. You know, they'd have already had that conversation. It's like it seems to me that Franklin's just turned up and he's got the goods. You know, he's got the thing that presumably Arden's been waiting for, hoping for. Mm. So this, I think, it is intimate, but I think there could be a certain amount of contrast as well between Arden, clearly isn't a morning person, so which I can sympathize with. So like he's obviously, you know, bringing one kind of energy into the exchange, but then Franklin coming in, you know, maybe with the fresh breezes and good news. And to kind of set up that contrast of energies between, on the one hand, like oh, still maybe slightly hungover from the night before, a bit stale, a bit weary, clearly very depressed. And then this kind of, you know, fresh from his morning walk, good news in his hands, literally, with Franklin. That could be quite a nice, you know, dynamic to develop on audio.
Yes, the idea that, yeah, maybe Arden's just sleeping in his study. You know, he's sleeping on the sofa. He doesn't want to sleep with his wife. Kind of situation here. Because, you know, obviously he's brooding a lot. And just the thing about the property, the stuff, that all this deed stuff is really very important to who Arden is as well, because he's doing a bit of a land grab. You know, this is, you know, he's not a nice guy. Mm. And that's actually one of the things hinted at in the source, but is actually, they don't go into much detail on that. The play really plays up on is that actually, you know, we're sort of not sympathetic. We kind of want him to die until the actual brutal fact of it occurs. And of course, mentioning the Duke of Somerset, we are, you know, in the 1550s, just before he actually gets killed himself. He doesn't last long after this point. It's setting it in a period, so it's already set in the past, and for us it's in the past, so question of period's really important as well. Bryony, then Sarah.
Yeah, just I think, I mean, obviously now we know now that it's in the morning, but I think if you did play too heavily into, like, alcohol, then it almost takes away a bit of how, when Arden makes it really dark and starts talking about the blood and the dismembered and all that stuff, you know, if you're drunk, then it's, you know, maybe a bit more excusable somehow. Whereas if you know, just woken up, you may be a bit hungover, but you're sober in the cold light of day, it's a very different tone then to what he's saying.
Mm. And, you know, so at the moment I've got birdsong noted down. You know, it's the birds are singing. You know, it's actually, it's almost working against the tone of the scene. Because I say, I leapt for night just reading that bit. But actually, it's perhaps he's on the veranda with his coffee and his morning paper kind of thing. Or he's working in his office or doing something. But he's in the dumps. You know, cheer up thy spirits. I mean, this thing, he immediately tells us that Arden's in a foul mood in the first line. So maybe a lot of opening sighing from Arden there in the absence of... Arden size. I'm actually going to type that in. There we are. Size. I don't think he'd open the door himself, but I quite like the idea. Ding dong. Oh, cheer up. I'm not going to go there. It's fine. Sarah.
Well, partly I was going to say exactly what Brian has just said about that speech being... way more shocking and disturbing if it's a morning speech. But also just that speech itself, just to tie it back into what you were saying about, you know, setting up Arden's character. There is a, I mean, this is true crime rather than murder mystery, but there is a, you know, a sort of very well-worn trope in murder mysteries that you set the victim up to be awful. It's, you know, it's like, it's the reason why in Agatha Christie, the you can always tell who the murder victim's going to be, because it's always the really ghastly, either patriarch or matriarch of the family who, you know, everybody hates. And it's like, oh yeah, okay, there we go. Might as well have victim written across their forehead. But, you know, given that this is perhaps the earliest, or certainly one of the earliest, okay, it's a true crime drama, but it's still a drama, murder dramas that we've got. This is actually, you know, interesting to see this trope here. Mm. You know, this thing of like, he's not a nice man. He is really not pleasant, you know, in this first little exchange, we've already learnt that he's a misogynist. And, you know, he doesn't just fantasize about killing his rival. He fantasizes about seeing his dissevered joints and sinews torn. So, you know, it's really well structured. And to kick off the you know, the play with that. It's not wasting any time. It's kind of very economical.
Because of course, you know, the golden age of crime fiction does that because they want to increase the number of people who want to kill the central protagonist. And in a sense, that's exactly what Arden does. The number of people who are trying to kill Arden, I think it's about 7 plots. I mean, I don't think there are 7 people involved in those plots, but I think it's a good handful of people are trying to kill him. So it's less a matter of who done it as who's going to get round to doing it in the end. Because place your bets who's actually going to kill Arden. Because it proliferates as we go forward. I should have said at the beginning, you know, spoilers, we are going to talk about he dies at the end. there was a treatment for an opera called Arden Must Die. I don't know if it actually made it into the full thing in the end, but... it's a good alternative name. I went for a Killing Eve version. Anyway, we should move on. We have discussed at great length. Two people talking. They are joined by a third person. So, Bryony, if you could read Alice. So, you've been called for by Arden.
Husband, what mean you to get up so early? Summer nights are short, and yet you rise ere day. Had I been wake, you had not risen so soon.
Sweet love, thou knowest that we two, Ovid-like, have often chid the morning when it began to peep, and often wished that dark night's purblind steeds would pull by her the purple mantle back, and cast her in the ocean to her love. But this night, sweet Alice, thou hast killed my heart. I heard thee call on Mosby in thy sleep.
'Tis like I was asleep when I named him, for being awake he comes not in my thoughts.
Aye, but you started up and suddenly, instead of him, caught me about the neck.
Instead of him? Why, who was there but you? And where but one is, how can I mistake?
Arden, leave to urge her over far.
Nay, love, there's no credit in a dream. Let it suffice, I know thou lovest me well.
Now I remember whereupon it came. Had we no talk of Mosby yesternight?
Mistress Alice, I heard you name him once or twice.
And thereof it came, and therefore blame not me.
I know it did, and therefore let it pass. I must to London, sweet Alice, presently.
But tell me, do you mean to stay there long?
No longer there till my affairs be done.
He will not stay above a month at most.
A month? Ay me! Sweet Arden, come again within a day or two, or else I die.
I cannot be long from thee, gentle Alice. While Michael fetch our horses from the field, Franklin and I will down to the quay, for I have certain goods there to unload. Meanwhile, prepare our breakfast, gentle Alice. For yet ere noon, we'll take horses and away.
I'm just going to pause there, because again, we've got lots of things going on here. And it's a question for our expectations of the audience. We can expect... I mean, I don't know how well the story was known at the time. I assume it's reasonably well known that, you know, Alice was going to try and murder her husband. And, you know... But, you know, where are we throwing the audience? Because Alice is giving, you know, oh, no, it's all a dream. It was, you know, maybe she's having an affair. Maybe she's not. But, you know, it's all. Are we supposed to be feeling that Alice is lying? Or are we supposed to be feeling that Alice is absolutely genuine at this point? I mean, we know from the speech that Alice is about to make that she can't stand his guts and she wants him to die. But are we asking the audience to go in that direction? What point, because, you know, for all we know, maybe she'll change her mind later in the play and then want to kill him. So there's, because, and it's this thing about how people present themselves to each other. So Arden, you know, going, sweet love, it's like Richter's grin, smiling, oh, so happy to see you, dear, you talked about Mosby in your sleep, and, you know, turning it. So there's lots of these turning points I'm thinking here about how it's performed and how it works. Thoughts on the room? Bryony, then Alan, and then Sarah.
Yeah, there's that first little thing that she says. The last line of that is a bit kind of flirty and fun. And so I think she is definitely when she first steps into the scene, presenting as his sweet, lovely wife.
Alan?
Yeah, the last bit of the speech I did made me wonder about the social status of this couple. Because meanwhile, prepare our breakfast. Surely one has servants for things like that.
Well, I'm sure she will have servants to do that. I supervise the breakfast. Is I think the implication there. I don't think Alice is necessarily doing it herself. I'm not sure precisely how in a upper middle class. I mean, it's difficult to talk about class distinctions in early modern because it's slightly, but above middling sort. I think is probably where we're at. But yeah, it's a good question, actually. How practical in the kitchen is Alice, or is it she just giving the instructions? I suspect she's just giving the instructions. Sarah?
Yeah, I think so too. The fact that he's just been given letters patent on Faversham Abbey, I think they're probably quite wealthy. So I should imagine she has servants for that kind of thing. I was thinking less about differences in status as opposed to differences in age. There was just something about that speech where sweet love, thou knowest that we two Ovid like have often chid the morn when it gained to peep. There's that thing of older people sometimes do get up earlier in the mornings, whereas younger people tend to stay in bed longer. It's a generalization, I realize, but it's I'm wondering if there's a bit of an age gap. It just made me think, I wonder if there's a bit of an age gap between these two. In which case, there's not really then the necessary suggestion, just because she's having an affair, there's not necessarily the inevitable follow-on that she wants to have him murdered, because if she's younger than him and she's having an affair with some dashing young local dude and her husband's quite a bit older, then that's she wouldn't necessarily want to kill him. So even if she is lying, which I mean we kind of know she's lying because assuming that Arden is telling the truth, we already know he's already said that she's having an affair with Mosby. So that background info has already been given to the audience. But just because she's having an affair, it doesn't necessarily mean she wants to kill him. She might just be having a bit of a dalliance. And if she's married to a wealthy, this used to happen all the time. You got younger girls marrying wealthy older men, and the expectation was that eventually they'd drop off. So I don't know. It's the ambiguity is there, and you could certainly highlight that with the casting. Just because she's deceitful, it doesn't necessarily mean she's a murderer.
Bryony.
Also, just because he's convinced she's having an affair doesn't mean she actually is.
Yes,
he's been presented already as not the nicest, greatest character, so maybe at this point you could play with the audience and really have her seem like this sweet, lovely thing, so that there is this doubt as to whether he is this paranoid husband. I don't know, you could maybe have a bit more pull with the audience and play around a bit more if you present her in an unexpected way.
I mean, I think as ever with these things, it's a matter of that you do all this work, and we took work with the actors to pick out all these things, and then none of it comes across, or certainly not on a first listen. But I think it is all there. I mean, the other thing about this scene, this little scene, and it is a sort of little unit of action in its own right. That's why I paused it there. Is it's in front of Franklin. Franklin is this. And what sometimes happens with couples is, when there's somebody else there, they perform this thing of going, yes, of course, they never put the bins out. Of course, do you, dear? And it's like all the grievances that never get spoken of become this weird sort of performative ritual that is incredibly awkward to be in the room for, depending on how far it goes. And the way, because Franklin's almost gotten aside there, it's just to Arden, it's like through his teeth, you know, Arden, leave to urge her over far, don't you know, do you remember what we just said? Keep it light. And Franklin is then, you know, trying to pour oil on the waters, you know, Mistress Alice. I heard you mention him the other day as well, you know. Oh, yes, we always talk about things that we talked about in our dreams. You know, we dream about things we were talking about earlier. Yeah, the performative nature of this as well, in front of a witness, that interests me too. Sarah?
There's a performative aspect to it. There's also a safety net aspect as well, because if you accuse your wife of sleeping with someone else and it's just the two of you, that's going to be a very different conversation to the one that you have if you've got a witness there and the witness is your best friend.
It's a big thing to do that in public, actually. I mean, it's almost like Franklin is going, I didn't hear that you say that, because that's a public accusation, you know, that's slander. And I would not be surprised if at the period that would have been massive, actually, to do, you know, considerably more than for us today.
So there's a kind of, there's a safety thing in it almost of like he wants that witness there when he accuses her.
I think it's almost more dangerous. I think I think it's the reverse. I mean, he doesn't accuse her explicitly. He just says you talked about him in your sleep. I heard you call out. You know, that made me sad. So I mean, maybe we have a pre scene of, you know, Osby. Arden gets out of bed, goes down, you know, that's what happened the night before. And, you know, Arden, I think, has a right to be a bit pissed off about that, actually. You know, I think that would be quite hurtful if that happened. Doesn't necessarily excuse the language he uses and what goes on, but, you know, that's a genuine reason to be upset, perhaps. Okay, let us go on a little bit more. We'll take in Alice's next speech and the entrance of Adam to the end of Alice's speech afterwards as well. I don't think Adam turns up again. Sarah, you can read Adam as we go through. So, Alice, you've been Arden and Franklin have left you alone to talk to the audience.
Ere noon he means to take horse and away? Sweet news is this. Oh, that some airy spirit would in the shape and likeness of a horse gallop with Arden across the ocean and throw him from his back into the waves. Sweet Mosby is the man that hath my heart, and he usurps it, having naught but this, that I am tied to him by marriage. Love is a god, and marriage is but words. And therefore Mosby's title is the best. Tush, whether it be or no, he shall be mine, in spite of him, of Hymen, and of rights. And here comes Adam of the Flower de Luce. I hope he brings me tidings of my love. How now, Adam? What is the news with you? Be not afraid, my husband is now from home.
Mosby, Mistress Alice, is come to town and sends you word by me. In any case, you may not visit him.
Not visit him?
No, nor take no knowledge of his being here.
But tell me, is he angry or displeased?
It should seem so, for he is wondrous sad.
Were he as mad as raving Hercules, I'll see him, I... And were thy house of force, these hands of mine should race it to the ground, unless that thou wouldst bring me to my love.
Nay, and you be so impatient, I'll be gone.
Stay, Adam, stay. Thou wert wont to be my friend. Ask Mosby how I have incurred his wrath. Bear him from me these pair of silver dice, with which we played for kisses many a time, and when I lost, I won, and so did he. Such winning and such losing Jove sent me. and bid him, if his love do not decline, to come this morning but along my door, and as a stranger but salute me there. This may he do without suspect or fear.
I'll tell him what you say, and so farewell.
Do, and one day I'll make amends for all. I know he loves me well, but dares not come, because my husband is so jealous, and these my narrow prying neighbours blab, hinder our meetings when we would confer. But if I live, that block shall be removed, and Mosby, thou that comes to me by stealth, shall neither fear the biting speech of men, nor Arden's looks, and surely shall he die as I abhor him and love only thee.
Okay, quite a lot has just gone down in incredibly short period. It's interesting, we have these really, I mean, it's all technically one scene, but it's lots of interlocking ongoing scenes, and there's big ups and downs in them as well. I mean, Alice is going, oh God, if only my husband would die, because I love Mosby so much. It's so great. He's, you know, and who cares about marriage? And, you know, these are that's just a ceremony, you know, whereas, you know, I obey God of love. And then Adam comes in and says, no, he's not into you. And he's just, what? Tell him to come over here now. And we too turned from the sort of idle talk about getting rid of Arden by the end of that second speech. Kill him. Surely shall he die. You know, there's a resolution coming in, and it seems to be a journeying resolution. It's not like you've started the morning going, I think I'll kill my husband today. It's like this has provoked it, which is interesting. Brani.
Yeah, I think having done that next bit, I think I would definitely want to present her initially as really sweet and play up the doubt as to whether he's imagined all this, and because then that speech has so much more impact and contrast. And I also, I think, yeah, the fun bit is the differences in the way people act depending on who they're interacting with. I think you have a lot of fun with that.
Sarah?
You could also still maintain a bit of ambiguity here, because the fact that, you know, this clearly takes her by surprise. It's like, what? What do you mean he doesn't want to see me? You know, saying something like, oh, well, you know, just tell him, my husband, you know, my husband, he's going to die, because I only love Mosby. So, you know, just tell him that, you know, we'll find a way to get my husband out of the way. Yeah, okay. It's not exactly a very wonderful thing to say, but it is the kind of thing that she might be saying in panic. To, you know, if she thinks that her lover's gone off in a strop and doesn't want to see her anymore, she might not actually mean it. Okay, we know that she does, but again, in terms of playing with the audience's expectations, you could still keep that as slightly ambiguous if you kind of play it that she's really just panicking and will probably say anything in order to get her lover to come and see her.
And we got this little part of Adam. I need to double check the doubling chart, which I don't have up in front of me, but I'm not sure if Adam really turns up very much again. It might turn up later towards the end of the play, but I'm just going, does Adam do anything else in the entire play? Is he just some random servant type person? Oh no, it does turn up at the end. Yeah, there is a return of Adam, but doesn't say a lot. So there's always a part of me going, can one conflate characters? Can I conflate Adam with another character? I don't know if we can. I don't know if we have that many servants in the household or that many people about. So that's just a question I'm sort of raising with myself at the moment. I do love the way Adam just sort of goes, you know, when she's talking about, you know, where he's mad as Raven Hercules, and Adam's just going, well, I'm out of here. I'm not, you know, this is, I mean, there's a slight misogynistic edge to that, but there is also a thing of, Alice is using some very highfalutin language at this point, and I don't think Adam's here for that at all. Alan?
Yeah, I must admit, it's not explicitly stated, but I get the feeling that Adam is actually mine host at the local inn. is the way it came across to me.
Oh, yes, because he's a Fleur-de-Lis, isn't he? Yes, so
he's... Being the local pub.
Yes, no, he absolutely is landlord. Absolutely is. So, random exterior dude. But again, I'm not sure how structurally used he is on that note, which I'm sort of interested in, you know. Because, of course, we have got people meeting in potentially inns later on. So I'm wondering whether more can be made or less can be made. It's sort of odd. I need to look into Adam. That interests me. How do we get the I mean, I know it says Adam of the Fleur-de-Lis, or the Flower de Luce. Yeah, we've also got to describe... I think we had this problem last time. I couldn't decide on Mosby or Mosby. those things. Other thoughts before we move on, because we're barely about a sixth of the way through this scene, which is fine. It's fine, absolutely fine. So Adam, I suppose in that sense, if he's not a servant character in that sense, he may be slightly lower status, but he's still, you know, he's got his own life. If Alice is going off on one in that way, it's a very different... he would just sort of go, I'm not getting paid for this, goodbye. Kind of attitude makes sense. Okay, well, landlord knows all the gossip, I'm sure. So now we have, Alice has been left alone, and Michael enters. So we get another name. I don't like him. We have lots of names added in relatively quick succession. This is a servant type person. Ah, that's why I was getting confused in my mind. This is a servant type person. So, Alan, if you could read Michael this time.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a problem. We'll see how it goes. Bryony Remain as Alice. So here enters Michael.
How now, Michael? Whither are you going?
To fetch my master's nag. Hope you'll think on me.
Aye, but Michael, see you keep your oath and be as secret as you are resolute.
Our sea shall not live above a week.
On that condition, Michael, here's my hand. None shall have Mosby's sister but thyself.
I understand the painter here hard by have made a report that he and Sue is sure.
There's no such matter, Michael, believe it not.
But he hath sent a dagger sticking in a heart, with a verse or two stolen from a painted cloth, the which I hear the wench keeps in her chest. Well, let her keep it. I shall find a fellow that can both write and read, and make rhyme too. And if I do, well, I say no more. I've sent from London such a taunting letter as she shall eat the heart he sent with salt and fling the dagger at the painter's head.
What needs all this? I say that Susan's thine.
Why then, I say that I will kill my master or anything that you'll have me do.
But Michael, see you do it cunningly.
Why, so I should be took. I'll ne'er confess that you know anything. Susan, being a maid, may beg me from the gallows of the sheriff.
Trust not to that, Michael.
Gonna tell me. I've seen it. Aye. But, mistress, tell her, whether I live or die, I'll make her more worth than 20 painters can, for I will rid mine elder brother away, and then the farmer Bolton is mine own, who would not venture upon house and land, when he may have it for a right down blow.
Yonder comes Mosby. Michael, get thee gone, and let not him or nor any know of thy drift.
So that's it for Michael. So once again, we have a random character's come through. He's a servant. And in this incredibly contracted space of time, we are informed that she's already co-opted in to murder her husband. So, I mean, this is... Alice just sort of goes by stages. But even though it's actually already been sorted out ages ago, and again, a lot of these promises, how much of this is she capable of keeping or is interested? And Michael, how much of this is bluster? I will make a rid mine elder brother away stuff. So how old is Michael? Because he could be quite young and impressionable by the sounds of it. And, you know, is Alice flirting with him a little bit as well? Even though, you know, he's talking about, oh, we'll get you, Sue. But, you know, is there... What's going on in this scene? And there's a lot, I hope you'll think on me. There's places one can place weight in this scene, possibly too much. Again, because there's so little actual words, you could easily overplay everything. But I'll go to Alan, then Sarah, then Bryony.
I must admit, the longer we're getting into this, and I mean, we're only 5 pages or so into it, the more I'm getting a feeling that Alice is the trophy wife. She's considerably younger. She's probably a bit of a honeypot. She'll flirt with anything in trousers to get what she wants, and to hell with the consequences.
Sarah.
I was strongly reminded in that scene of... there's a film from the 90s called To Die For, which I have a feeling that might be based on a true crime story as well. And it's this local wife who has a younger lover who she gets to kill her husband. And I mean, Michael is not her younger lover in this case. That's Mosby. But I do really feel she's playing with him here. And that whole speech by Michael's about how the painter, you know, he's Michael is clearly has a crush on Mosby's sister, who I think that's Sue, isn't it? That's Susan. And the fact that he knows that there's this random painter dude who's been sending her letters or pictures, you know, with the dagger going through the heart, which I guess is the early modern equivalent of like the arrow, you know, through the heart. And he's just so caught up by this. It's comical. It's really kind of funny. So he's this weird character. He's on the one hand, he's kind of almost straying into clown territory, I think, in that speech. And yet on the other hand, he's also like, you know, he's the murderer. So or the would-be murderer, at least. So
murderer number one, please.
Yes. I'm not entirely sure. I do get the impression she's really playing with him. I don't think she gives a monkey's whether he ends up with Mosby. She probably would go a long way to stop him ending up with Mosby's sister if all her plots come to pass, because she wouldn't want him ending up with this. She wouldn't want the murderer ending up with the sister of her lover, who she'd be free to marry, of course. Once Arden's out of the way, but like there's a real sense that she's sort of spinning him a line here, and he is kind of that whole thing about he could be one of those really nefarious teenagers who kind of has fantasies about murdering his brother and kind of like he could be quite an unpleasant character, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be terribly effective.
Yeah, and there's something very teenagery about him as well. And you know, even though it's supposedly set in the 1550s, it does feel like Michael's gone to see a lot of plays from the late 1580s, because it's all a bit Spanish tragedy-ish and Tancred and Gismunda. It's looking ahead to Tis Pity, She's a Whore, with the stuff about the dagger and the heart on it, and it's all that sort of stuff where you're sort of going, yeah, you've watched a few too many films, mate. It's just he's got this idea that is a bit out of step. Bryony.
Yeah, I completely agree with what everybody said about this dynamic between them. It's there in the words. He does come across in this kind of teenage way. I think it's really interesting as well that the romantic imagery in his speech is also so violent. It's a dagger sticking into a heart, and it's that like you say about a teenager who's almost like he's seen too many gory films and stuff, and he's like fantasizing about the wrong things. He's just got it all mixed up in his head. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. And I think that actually that there is a point there, you know, that in the words here, because actually, you know, we're talking about, you know, the question of adaptation. But so far, it's fairly clear who everybody is. We might need to throw in a couple of extra names here and there. We could add a bit of scene setting. I mean, if we decided to slightly switch it up a bit and say that Alice is actually cooking breakfast or something when, you know, there's additional sound stuff going on, we could do that. I don't think we need to. It is just a series of conversations that are, you know, the listener has to be keeping their ear out. It's always quite hard work, the amount of information coming at you early in a play, but the language is clear enough. I don't think there's much that needs to be done so far, which is pleasing because it saves me doing any work. It makes me very happy. Okay, let's go on then to... we've heard a lot about him. We've heard about a lot about Mosby from the very, very beginning. So now we actually get to meet. So Bryony, remain as Alice, Sarah, you can be Mosby or Mosby, depending on your particular preference. I'm sure the verse will give us a clue at some point. I'm sure there is a preferred version. I can never remember. You know what I'm like. I'm terrible at these things. Okay, yonder he comes. Alice, call out to him.
Mosby, my love.
Away, I say, and talk not to me now.
A word or two, sweetheart, and then I will. It is yet but early days, thou needst not fear.
Where is your husband?
'Tis now high water, and he is at the quay.
There, let him be. Henceforward, know me not.
Is this the end of all thy solemn oaths? Is this the fruit thy reconcilement buds? Have I, for this, given thee so many favours, incurred my husband's hate, and out, alas, made shipwreck of mine honour for thy sake? And dost thou say, henceforward know me not? Remember when I locked thee in my closet, what were thy words and mine? Did we not both decree to murder Arden in the night? The heavens can witness, and the world can tell. Before I saw that falsehood look of thine, before I was tangled with thy ticing speech, Arden to me was dearer than my soul, and shall be still. Base peasant, get thee gone, and boast not of thy conquest over me, gotten by witchcraft and mere sorcery, for what hast thou to countenance my love? Being descended of a noble house, and matched already with a gentleman whose servant thou mayest be. And so farewell.
Ungentle and unkind Alice. Now I see that which I ever feared, and find too true. A woman's love is as the lightning flame, which even in bursting forth consumes itself. To try thy constancy, have I been strange? Would I had never tried, but lived in hope.
What needst thou to try me, whom thou ne'er found false?
Yet pardon me, for love is jealous.
So lists the sailor to the mermaid's song, so looks the traveller to the basilisk. I am content for to be reconciled, and that I know will be mine overthrow.
Thine overthrow? First let the world dissolve.
Nay, Mosby, let me still enjoy thy love, and happen what will, I am resolute. My saving husband hoards up bags of gold to make our children rich, and now is he gone to unload the goods that shall be thine, and he and Franklin will to London straight.
To London, Alice? If thou be ruled by me, we'll make him sure enough of coming there.
Oh, would we could!
I happened on a painter yesternight, the only cunning man of Christendom, for he can temper poison with his oil, that whoso looks upon the work he draws shall, with the beams that issue from his sight, suck venom to his breast and slay himself. Sweet Alice, he shall draw thy counterfeit, that Arden may, by gazing on it, perish.
I, but Mosby, that is dangerous for thou or I or any other else coming into the chamber where it hangs may die.
Aye, but we'll have it covered with a cloth and hung up in the study for himself.
It may not be, for when the picture's drawn, Arden, I know, will come and show it me.
Fear not. We'll have that shall serve the turn. This is the painter's house. I'll call him forth.
But Mosby, I have no such... I'll have no such picture, I.
I pray thee, leave it to my discretion. How?
And Clark? There will pause, because interesting questions arise. Lots of interesting questions are asked here. And so, first off, I'll start with at the end of what we've just done, which is they've moved.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting question as to this is a moving conversation, which is fine. We can do that on audio. That's absolutely fine. You know, they go talk not now to me, Alice chases or something like that. Footsteps, gravel on drive, you know, street. That's fine or similar. So this is on the go in some way, shape or form. And that actually asks an interesting question about, again, where do you find privacy? You don't necessarily find it in the house. Maybe you find it in the field or around the corner or, you know, behind a bush or whatever, but where there are less likely for people to be. So, yeah. And when do they go on the move in this scene? Lots of practical questions. That raises. I mean, I don't think it's a big place, Faversham, certainly at the time. Relatively, you know, small, so it's an interesting question. But all sorts of other questions come out about this scene, but we'll just deal with this one and then move on. Sarah, then Bryony.
That really startled me because this is not, I mean, I take your point about the fact that, oh, okay, maybe you get more privacy outside than in the house, but this is not a conversation that you want to have in the open air, I wouldn't have thought. And I don't know, this might be a place where I'd be tempted to tinker and adapt slightly, because I think if you have this conversation going along, you know, with footsteps, and they're walking along having it, I think you're going to take some of the dramatic tension out of it. You know, this is the really intimate conversation with these two people, with these two lovers plotting to murder a husband. I just think if they're walking along having this in the fresh air, I feel that that's going to take something away from it somehow.
I agree in terms of, you know, when they're actually physically walking, that, but they can stop, and you know, you can make that work, and it, you know, it might just be a, you know, down the road. Yeah, Bryony.
I'm not that familiar with doing just audio stuff, so I don't know whether or not this how possible or achievable this would be. But I wondered whether you could soundscape the fact that they're outside and maybe at key points in their conversation have, say, the noise of a passing car, and suddenly they have to just and whether you could bring that jeopardy of the fact they are having this very private conversation somewhere outdoors, whether you could work that into it, because otherwise the twists and turn of the what the characters do in this scene is a bit random. I don't know. I just the way he like tests her at the start, just weird. But I feel like if then suddenly they were having this conversation and you were like feeling this tension of like, oh,
I mean,
and then having to like carry on their line like this because somebody's just gone past and you need to be more careful, you know. And I don't know whether or not you could get that through to an audience or not.
I mean, going on Sarah's point, I mean, it is tweakable for that. You know, to make it just a very small street with everything nearby. So, you know, rather than this is the painter's house, you know, there's the painter's house. I'll, you know, and just wave, I'll call him forth, cross street. But do it that way. I think it's a really good question of actually how to play this scene. I mean, Let's talk about actually what's happening in the scene, because I think that may also give us things to discuss, because I'm just looking at our notes from the first time we did this, and I've just got constantly written, oh yeah, sure, in the margin. You know, they're lying to each other all the time. I mean, they're clearly constantly lying. It's like, Mosby says, I'm moving on, I don't want anything to do with you, and Alice goes for him, and then he immediately says, oh, it was a test of your constancy. Yeah, it was. Sure it was. And then this whole thing about the point, we get the painter again. I love the integration of the painter. This is a really complicated series of relationships. And you could just see this going horribly wrong. I don't think this is in the source. I don't think the murderous painter is actually there. I think he's there as the source of poison. But I don't think anything about this whole painting giving off, you know, you look at the painting and it makes you think. So that, again, feels, I mean, it's very future echoey, because it's the kind of thing you get in a Jacobean tragedy in Act 5, you know, whatever. So, yeah, it's really interesting. Bryony, then Sarah.
The thing that grated on me with that test at the start the most is the fact that she doesn't really pass it and he doesn't really care. You know what I mean? She instantly turns on him and is like, fine, then I'll go back to my husband. You bewitch me anyway, and accuses him of like witchcraft and stuff, which is quite a serious thing to say to somebody at this time still, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And yet he then doesn't really, okay, well, you failed my test, so I'm glad I did it. Bye, bitch. There's like no repercussions. So I didn't, that's why that bit kind of baffled me more than
Again, it's one that feels like you need the physicality of the two people in the room to make it work. I mean, again, for an audio context, what you want is that moving away, moving togetherness that's going on here, and the sound of fabric that they get close, you know, and that we can interpret all sorts of, you know, additional stuff that they might be doing to one another at certain points in this, because I think it's got to be flirty fighting at times, and how we negotiate this once they're into it again. And then of course I've also written in the margin, this is a terrible plan. This is a terrible plan. If nothing else, because it's the second murder plot, which directly undermines murder plot number one, because who's going to marry Sue? What are you going to do about Sue? Who does Sue want to marry? Does anyone ever ask Sue who she wants to marry? Probably not. Sarah.
Yeah, that was going to be my point. It's like, this makes no sense whatsoever. And I'm not surprised that the whole poisonous painting thing wasn't in the original story, because it's like this is so contrived, and it makes no sense that she would have just literally just sent Michael off with instructions to murder her husband, promising him Sue as a, you know, I mean, I suppose you could say, oh, maybe Mosby didn't know that she's done that, and so he's come up with his own plot, and it just happens to involve the same guy who is Michael's rival. But oh my God, that's complicated. The other thing I was going to say was this whole thing of the test and failing the test. That to me says a lot about who Mosby is as a character, because, like, let's face it, he's not going anywhere. If she really does manage to find a way to murder her husband, then he's in line. I mean, she actually says it. He's in line to, you know, get all that money. He's going to marry her, and he's immediately going to get his hands on all her property, all her wealth. There is no way that he's going to, like, test her for love. Or if she does fail the test, he's going to just shrug and go, oh yeah, okay then, because I think that's probably what he's after here. So then the test, if it's not an actual test, it becomes like a really weird and unsavory little power play, which I think is a more interesting way to go with his character.
Yeah, I again, this is one to throw all sorts of actor rehearsal time at, because I think getting this opening is very important, actually, because the so many people are lying, either to themselves or to each other. Okay, so yes, I've got. I'm just looking at my notes again for the next scene. Susan as bargaining chip is the note I've got down here. So we have the entrance of the painter Clark. Interestingly, that's not the original chap's name. Apparently, he was called William Blackburn. Which raises an interesting question with later elements of the text. But we'll come to that when we come to it. Alan, if you could be the painter in your most painterly guise, and let's see where this goes. So, must be call for Clark.
How? Clark? Oh, you are an honest man of your word. You serve me well.
Why, sure, I'll do it for you at any time, provided, as you have given your word, I may have Susan Mosby to my wife. For, as sharp-witted poets, whose sweet verse make heavenly gods break off their nectar draughts and lay their ears down to the lowly earth, use humble promise to their sacred muse, so we, that are the poet's favourites, must have a love. Aye, love is the painter's muse that makes him frame a speaking countenance, a weeping eye that witnesses heart's grief. Then tell me, Master Mosby, shall I have her?
'Tis pity, but he should. He'll use her well.
Clark, here's my hand. My sister shall be thine.
Then, brother, to requite this courtesy, you shall command my life, my skill, and all.
Ah, that thou couldst be secret.
Fear him not. Leave. I have talked sufficient.
You know not me that ask such questions. Let it suffice, I know you love him well, and fain would have your husband made away. Wherein, trust me, you show a noble mind, that rather than you'll live with him you hate, you'll venture life and die with him you love. The like will I do for my Susan's sake.
Yet nothing could enforce me to the deed but Mosby's love. Might I without control enjoy thee still, then Arden should not die, but seeing I cannot, therefore let him die.
Enough, sweet Alice. Kind words make me melt. Your trick of poison pictures we dislike. Some other poison would do better far?
Aye, such as might be put into his broth, and yet in taste not to be found at all.
I know your mind, and here I have it for you. Put but a dram of this into his drink, or any kind of broth that he shall eat, and he shall die within an hour thereafter.
As I am a gentlewoman, Clark, next day thou and Susan shall be married.
And I'll make her dowry more than I'll talk of, Clark.
Yonder's your husband. Mosby, I'll be gone.
And sometime around here enters Arden and Franklin. We return to the more plausible thing of you go to a painter to get poison to just put in food into the broth and do that, because they're likely to be dealing with, you know, dangerous substances because they're mixing all sorts of chemicals and stuff together. Alan,
I'm just trying to remember whether we've actually come across this idea of a painting which has lethal force somewhere else, or whether it's a vague recollection of when we looked at this 18 months ago.
In your case, it's probably been in a script that you've edited. I don't think you've covered play. There are plays in the future that have all sorts of ingenious ways in which people get poisoned by objects, some of which are a bit like this. That doesn't mean to say there wasn't a play prior to this that may have done that kind of gig. It feels, the way it's crowbarred in there, it does feel like it's some sort of reference to a thing, because I don't think there's any reference to it in the source beyond they went to the painter to get some poison. Yeah, at length, she at length, inflamed in love with Mosby and loathing her husband, wished and after practice the means how to hasten his end. There was a painter dwelling in Feversham who had skill of poisons, as was reported. She therefore demanded of him whether it were true that he had such skill in that feat or not. And he denied not, but that he had indeed. Yea, said she, but I would have had such a one made as should have most vehement and speedy operation to dispatch the eater thereof. That can I do, quoth he, and forthwith made her such a one, and willed her to put it into the bottom of a porringer. So, so that's the Hollingshed source. And as I say, there's no mention of the painter actually doing magic painting poison stuff. It is the playwright throwing that stuff in. Yeah, there's odd little lines in there. So we could easily make the painter just walking by. This is the painter passing, I'll call him forth. Whistles out the window, come on in, mate. It's this weird, oh, you are an honest man of your word, you served me well. I don't know what that refers to. Has he brought a box of poisons with him, and that's what he's referring to? Sarah.
I mean, it could just be, and this would actually tie in with the adapting tweak you just suggested. Like, it could be that he said to him, "Can you loiter outside the house? Can you stay? Can you just stay outside, and I'll call you when I'm ready for you." Mm. And he's served him well just because he's literally just stood there and hung around. I mean, it could be something that prosaic, or he could have something with him. But I think if he had something with him, you'd want a whole scene with him looking at the different poisons. And yeah.
Did they actually, by the end of the scene, hand over a poison of this into his drink? So I think he's come on with a box.
Hmm.
And I think that's what that line is referring to. I haven't got a gloss on it anywhere as to what it means. So I'm going with that. Here enters Clark with stuff. Obviously, that's a visual thing. But maybe we put something in there. You're an honest man of your word. Is that the poison? You know, or I don't know. Something. It's always a bit cheesy when you put in a half line of exposition and trying to make it sound not horribly clunky. And often I just don't bother trying to make it not so. Sort of like a English heritage kind of thing. You put on a clunky additional side structure so as not to confuse the archaeologists. Bryony.
Well, speaking of that, I don't know how relevant it is, but it struck me as being oddly clunky that Clark says, "I may have Susan Mosby to my wife." Mm. Like, so, because when he first said it, I'm thinking, like, because I wouldn't, you know, if someone came up to me and said, "I really fancy your brother, Gareth Sparrow," that'd be weird. Like, it's Gareth, I know what his surname is. It's mine too. Mm. And so I thought when he first said it, I thought, well, does he not, maybe not know who he is? But then he says he calls him Master Mosby at the end. So I'm like, I don't know, it was just weird.
Yeah, I think that's just one of those conventions of people randomly saying, or just to make the line scan kind of thing. I agree. I always hate that in dramas when people use full names for no readily apparent reason, repeatedly for no readily apparent reason. When, you know, nobody really does that in real life. Alan Scott.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, in fact, whether it will be period authentic to use full name rather than just a given name.
Hmm. Well, nobody's really been doing it elsewhere in the play. Everyone's been using a singular.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking through a number of the plays we've done where the full name trope has been used.
Hmm.
And I just wonder whether that's authentic.
Hmm. I don't think it's occurred enough to say it's a thing. But maybe it is. I do not know. Right. Can we get to a logical end point? We're not going to get to the end of the scene. That's not going to happen in the time we have remaining, which is fine. But where shall we go to? I think... we're possibly at it, actually. Oh no, let's read on. Who was Arden earlier? Okay, you're currently. Do you say anything?
No, Clark exits.
Oh, Clark exits. So that's all right. You can be come back in as. And who was Franklin? It was Sarah. Sarah, you're currently Mosby, aren't you? So if I do Franklin, because I don't think Franklin says very much. And yeah, we'll go to the exit of Mosby. And that seems to. Can we get to that far? Maybe, maybe not. We shall see. See how far we get. Let's just rattle on for a bit and see how far we go. And I'll step in to be whoever is clashing. So I'll be Franklin for the foreseeable. So enter Arden and Franklin. I won't read any more stage directions.
In good time, see where my husband comes, Master Mosby. Ask him the question yourself.
Master Arden, being at London yesternight, the Abbey lands whereof you are now possessed were offered me on some occasion by Green, one of Sir Anthony Ager's men. I pray you, sir, tell me, are not the lands yours? Hath any other interest herein?
Mosby, that question will decide anon. Alice, make ready my breakfast. I must hence. As for the lands, Mosby, they're mine by letters patents from His Majesty. But I must have mandate for my wife. They say you seek to rob me of her love. Villain, what makes thou in her company? She's no companion for so base a groom.
Arden, I thought not on her. I came to thee. But rather than I pocket up this wrong...
What will you do, sir?
Revenge it on the proudest of you both.
I said I wasn't going to read a stage direction, but I will. Then Arden draws forth Mosby's sword.
So, sirrah, you may not wear a sword. The statute makes against artificers. I warrant that I do. Now use your bodkin, your Spanish needle, and your pressing iron. For this you'll go with me, and mark my words. You goodman botcher, tis you, to you I speak. The next time that I take thee near my house, instead of legs, I'll make thee crawl on stumps.
Master Arden, you have injured me. I do appeal to God and to the world.
Why, canst thou deny thou wert a botcher once?
Measure me what I am, not what I was.
Why, what art thou now but a velvet drudge, a cheating steward and a base-minded peasant?
Arden, now thou hast belched and vomited the rancorous venom of thy misswollen heart, hear me but speak. As I intend to live with God and his elected saints in heaven, I never meant more to solicit her. And that she knows. And all the world shall see. I loved her once. Oh, sweet Arden, pardon me. I could not choose. Her beauty fired my heart. But time hath quenched these overraging coals. And Arden, though I now frequent thy house, 'tis for my sister's sake, her waiting maid, and not for hers. Mayst thou enjoy her long, hellfire and wrathful vengeance light on me if I dishonour her or injure thee.
Mosby, with these thy protestations, the deadly hatred of my heart's appeased, and thou and I'll be friends, if this prove true. As for the base terms I gave thee late, forget them, Mosby. I had cause to speak when all the knights and gentlemen of Kent make common table talk of her and thee.
Who lives that is not touched with slanderous tongues?
Then, Mosby, to eschew the speech of men upon whose general bruit all honour hangs, forbear this house.
Forbear it? Nay, rather frequent it more. The world shall see that I distrust her not. To warn him on the sudden from my house were to confirm the rumour that is grown.
By my faith, sir, you say true. And therefore will I sojourn here a while until our enemies have talked their fill. And then, I hope, they'll cease and at last confess how causeless
They have injured her and me.
And I will lie at London all this term to let them see how light I weigh their words.
And we're going to pause there before Alice comes in with breakfast. So, again, it really doesn't show a nice side either of Franklin or as well as Arden, because it's really status-driven stuff again. You know, you get know your place, because he's, you know, Mosby makes this inquiry about the lands. Who got the lands? I had a promise of the lands, and he's going, no, I've got them. And then there's this thing. It's a question of what we do with the. I think we need to possibly throw in an indicator that Arden and Franklin come in, because Franklin, it's not clear he comes in for an audio sense. So we need to make Franklin's entrance clear. Maybe throwing in a rather cheesy Master Arden, Master Franklin. So that we know they're both in the room. But we have this physical action going on here, and it's a question of how active it is. Is it that Mosby is looking to draw a sword and Arden gets him first? Does Arden actually do anything with the sword? Because it has this line, Master Arden, you have injured me. I don't think that's a physical injury. I think that's you've hurt my pride. We need to make that clear. I'm not sure, because, of course, what Arden's pointing out, Arden is a gentleman. Arden can wear a sword. He is allowed to wear a sword. Mosby isn't. And so if he's got one, he is functioning above his station in life. So how we get that across, again, we might need to infer a sort of slightly clunky bit of dialogue. Sarah.
Yeah, I think I didn't help matters there, because having not read ahead, I thought there was actually some physical action going on here, and I thought the stakes were actually higher than they are. I think, in fact, he is just he's belittling him, basically, yep. and then that whole speech, which I did with far too much rancor, because the way the speech started, I thought that was how it was going, but then actually it wasn't at all. That speech, Arden, now that thou hast belched and vomited the rancorous venom of thy misswollen heart, I think that's actually, you know, an entire speech of grovelling. And so I rather than putting in any physical action, I think it's more that you play up the whole thing of like, you are a bug and I could squash you, and him going, oh, you know, fair cop gov, you know, yeah, I know you're so much better than I am. And oh yeah, I did love your wife once, but oh, that's all over now, because obviously she's so above me and so are you and blah, blah, blah. And sort of have him scuttling back into his hole there. Whereas the way I spoke it was just he was far too confrontational, but I don't think there's any confrontation here at all, actually. I think this is just another example of we're seeing another side of Mosby's lying that he does, like, in a different context.
Yes, he does the old I did love her once, but I don't now gambit double bluff thing. There's something really unpleasant about the way they use the, because they say you're wearing a sword, you can't wear a sword, you should be using a bodkin or a Spanish needle and your pressing iron. It's all about, you know, the kind of thing people of your sort should use, and getting that across quite hard. I think actually I might give Franklin one or two of those little parts of Arden's speech. So now use your bodkin, your Spanish needle, and, you know, and let them sort of brainstorm their word cloud outside the box, attack on Mosby there, so that it's because it's quite unpleasant, actually.
Even it really is. Yeah,
Franklin, I think, is supposed to come across as a reasonable guy, but I'm not actually sure so far that he is, actually. It's weird.
And also, if you did that, there'd be the sense of them like ganging up together on him. Because that's what you want, I think. You want the belittling. This isn't physical action. It's mental bullying that's going on. And you really want to get that across.
Alan?
I I think you could do a lot with accents, because if you have Arden and Franklin basically talking posh, Mosby in a slightly more rural one, and then you've got the people like the landlord who we met earlier and Michael who are probably full-blown rustic. You know, that you might actually manage to do that by using accent as the indicator of class. And I mean, the logic of the thing on the bodkin, the pressing iron and so on, is basically back to your tools of your trade on which you came from.
Yeah, don't ask for lands, and don't sleep with my wife. And right, Mosby's gambit there is a gambit, isn't it? It is this sort of mock. I think it's more mock, you know, subservience as well. I mean, it's a.
Rumble, sir.
Yeah, you know. Oh, I wouldn't. I would no. Oh, I wouldn't. Pardon me. Oh.
Never dreamt it'd be gov.
Yeah. To make that work. So yeah, it's again this constant. We haven't been introduced to too many characters, I think, as well. It's still. I mean, I was a bit worried when we kept getting these short, random people popping in, but it's still quite self-contained, and it's all sort of kept together. Bryony.
Yeah, I was thinking that myself, because again, not being that familiar with audio stuff, I presume if you have like too many voices at once, even if you've introduced the characters well, it probably could get confusing for the audience.
Yeah.
But there hasn't actually been more than three people talking at any point so far.
Yes, and that's a note on the accents. You want everyone to have a slightly different accent or a slightly different timbre of voice, because you've got to demonstrate who they are. And that's one of the things about casting audio, is actually you just want to make sure everyone sounds vocally distinct. And that's why it's quite useful to have quite a diverse cast, because if you've got an Englishman, a Scotsman, a Welshman and an Irishman,
you've got an old joke.
Not only do you expect them to walk into a bar, but you can follow who the hell they're supposed to be, and other, you know, accents and things as well. And yeah, I think the class study here is, I mean, originally, of course, the accent may have denoted class, but not in quite the way that we would have today. But I think we've got to communicate for a modern audience that logic. We're not going to go any further. We're about to go into the poisoning plot, the utilization of poison, which closes the scene. But I just don't think we have time to do it in the detail that is the point of this session. So we will pause there. So far, few terrors. I think minor tweaks, minor additions. I like the idea of recording this on location. You know, finding a house. It's always difficult when you do the outside stuff, making that land, because, you know, finding a nice outdoor location where there isn't traffic noise. And I don't think I'd want to set it in the modern day, though we could do. You know, the advantage of the modern day soundscape is that there are more noises available, whereas early modern, you know, clippy-cloppy horses, geese, bells, that's about it. I mean, it isn't, but it's a lot harder to break up scenes with soundscape. Sarah?
I only know this because I have a friend who was born and bred in Faversham. But Arden's house, I'm fairly certain, still exists. So you could always try and do it on location there. I don't know if it's privately owned or whether it's owned by the local council or whatever, but I'm fairly certain, because we drove past it once. It's the original half-timbered house, and it's got a little plaque on it saying, you know, Arden of Faversham was murdered here.
We're not short of creaky houses and things. I mean, as Alan's just put in the chat, you know, we basically live in creaky house county. We're surrounded by them. I like that idea. I like utilizing
I mean,
the
to do
acoustic
it site
of the space, and also the, you know, the relative size of spaces, but also the outside world. I think we need to find somewhere to do the outside, genuinely outside, if we're going to do location work for the interiors, rather than just
to do it site specific. Actually, at his house would be kind of cool.
Yeah, well, it would be cool, but it would be more expensive, and therefore, yeah, more tricky to do, and the additional publicity wouldn't necessarily earn us any additional money. But if they had a large enough hall and we could do it live with an audience, then that might be a different thing. Which is another option, because there's plenty of historic buildings that might work acoustically for that. But I can't at the moment double it down to less than 12 sensibly. And I don't like doing too much doubling with audio. It doesn't work as well as on stage when you can utilize visual signifiers. So that's one of the reasons why we're not leaping into this, is any play with a large cast automatically sort of goes into the workshop phase while we try and accumulate the resources to do a larger scale drama. Any final thoughts in the room from this bit of act one, scene one? We haven't even finished scene one. Otherwise, I will close the session. Alan?
Well, we've done about a fifth of the page count, haven't we? Coming up for.
Yeah, a little less than that, I think, in word terms. But yeah, we are on schedule. We're on schedule. Yeah. I didn't think we were going to finish the first scene. I'm planning to do this over about five or so sessions, but. You know, and there might be some bits we skip anyway. We don't have to do it all of the text in this level of detail. We didn't do all of Game at Chess. We did skip a few minor scenes. So yeah, we'll see what the exercise brings out. Okay, well, that's it from myself and the wonderful, wonderful team here, Sarah, Alan, Bryony. All that remains is to thank them for their wonderful reading. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye.